you want to hear my story about Empire of the Clouds, it'll take us 18 minutes to tell it. Anyway, no, it's an album in itself, isn't it, be honest. I mean, Iron Maiden, we're like, we work Monday through Friday, let's put it that way, right? So we go over to Paris, we're working from Monday through Friday. Bruce and I would get on the train, head back to London for the weekend, go back Monday morning. So picture this, I'm sitting on the train coming back to Paris and he's got a manuscript book, right, and a folder, and he's got loads of pieces of paper in it. He's got all these sketches of verse, chorus, double curl, this, that and the other. And I go, what are you doing? Oh, he said, it's a song called Empire of the Clouds, isn't it? I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, I'm writing it on the piano. I went, you what? I'm writing it on the piano. I said, you can't play the piano. He said, I've been playing it for 3 years now, Nick. He said, I've been learning. I went, have you? Oh, can I have a listen when we get to the studio? Yeah, what's it about then? Well, it's, let me tell you, it's about an airship. You what? It's about an airship, Nick. What do you mean it's about an airship, Bruce? Come on, you're having a laugh. No, it's about an airship. You heard about the R101? I said, yeah. Yeah, it was a massive big airship way back. He said, yeah. So anyway, this began the story.
What happened was I had a little bit that I'd been mucking about with on a keyboard at home. I nearly said piano there, but I did go to dinner with a concert pianist the other day and I said, I've got a little piano at home. She goes, that's not a piano. I said, actually, you're right, it's not. It's a little keyboard that sounds like a piano, but never mind, won't go there. So I had this idea and it was an atmospheric thing and it was the line in the songs as mist is in the trees, stone sweats with the dew, morning sunrise, red before the blue. So, you know, something is going to happen at dawn. It was to do with, you know, World War One and going to battle in these terribly dangerous, challenging machines and, you know, awful things happening to you. In the end, we ended up doing that with Death or Glory. So I was still left with this little atmospheric opening bit. And I'm sitting around at home and I'd just been to an airship auction, being a bit of an airship geek. And sitting around, I had a couple of bits of memorabilia from the R101 or associated with the R101 airship. I'd made models of it when I was a kid. I knew the story and the tragedy of it quite well, even though it's not a very well-known story these days. And I thought, maybe I could make something out of this. Maybe this could be the start point for something to do with the story of the R101 tragedy. And that's how the concept of the song started. So having come up with the idea of, yeah, this is what we're going to start the song about, I actually then had to start going back into the bit of research and figuring out the various things that happened to the airship, the background of it, the principal events that contributed to the demise of her. And as in most things like this, it's never one individual thing. It's a whole series of events. What in aviation accident speak they call the Swiss cheese. You can't see through them, but they're full of holes. But if you were to make slices of that Swiss cheese and then jiggle the slices around, one day all those holes will line up. And that's when you get an accident or a tragedy. And life's like that. It's lots of little slices. And if any one of those slices didn't have a hole in, that accident wouldn't happen. R101, very, very much the case. But of course, the issues with the aircraft, it was rushed into service. It was structurally quite fragile. It had terrible problems with the covering on its outer skin. It was underpowered. It had never been tested at full speed. Indeed, it never even completed testing. There was political pressure to go to India on a very prestigious trip that was to demonstrate the might of the empire, and of course it decided to go and do it into the teeth of a howling gale, basically a hurricane, which the airship should never ever have launched under those circumstances. And the final bit that put the nail in the coffin, as it were, was the airship, literally the front of it being torn off in the storm, at the bow starting to drop, and tragically the most experienced pilot to the coxswain, the most experienced coxswain, had now gone off shift and was in bed. And the less experienced guy, who is effectively kind of the cruise pilot, made the decision to cut the power. But of course, what that did was that just let the know nose drop even more because there was no forward thrust keeping the nose up. And of course, then as soon as the bow hit the ground, it stove the engines, which were hot, obviously, into the fabric, full of hydrogen and highly flammable. And also, bizarrely enough, the calcium flares, which the airship used to navigate, used to drop them into the ocean where they ignited on contact with water, and they could assess the drift of the wind to assist their navigation. Those flares were actually stored on the bottom of the airship, underneath the control car, above which were the main crew compartment. So effectively, when the airship hit the rain-soaked earth, all those flares ignited at once, as if to make sure that everybody was going to be incinerated quickly. Terrible, terrible thing. And the cry came from the front of the airship to the back. We're down, lads. Six people, I think, jumped from the rear power cars. Five of them, I believe, survived. I'm going to get my numbers straight here, but five of them certainly survived. And I have one of the little artifacts I have is the pocket watch of one of the survivors, inscribed to him, Airshipman A.V. Bell. So he was a survivor of that. So it was a very poignant story, a very human story, a story of ambition and incredible dedication by the crew and dreams, of course, dreams of flight, of literally an empire that was supposed to spread through the clouds to join the farthest parts of the British Empire together with these great sort of armadas of airships that were planned. And that was the crash was the end of the whole thing. So moving back to the song and how you tell that story, it was pretty clear that I needed a storm sequence. It was pretty clear that I needed the final plunge of the airship. And before that, I needed to build the tension and tell the story of what happened. And I compressed it into one day because it seemed to me to be the easiest and probably the only way to do it, really. So it starts off with a series of little themes. And the whole thing came back to front. So I had what ended up as a verse that was the atmospheric bit that was starting at the very beginning. So I had that. And then the next thing I did was tootling around on a piano. Then I wrote a variation on that. So that turned into a second version of a verse. So they kind of alternate through the beginning of the song. And then there's a refrain that links the two things. So just about then, I came up with the little intro piece, the ba-da-da-da-dum, ba-dum-bum-bum, which is, I suppose, a little sort of twee, little sort of Celtic-type thing. And it sounds almost sort of innocent, as it were. And so I quite like that. I thought, well, we could use that as a piece to, again, to come through the song. And in fact, it appears on, I think, three or four occasions. And at the very end, appears as a sort of a triumphant, almost marching thing, as a sort of a tribute to the sort of the fallen airmen who died in pursuit of their dream. And I'm sure that they would, if they were alive today, or if they could look down on us, they would say, "Well, just because we died is another reason why everything should carry on. That we didn't, do it for nothing, as it were." So going backwards again, if you like, writing the song backwards, I realized that I had one, two, three, four or five pieces now, components, before even getting into a storm or anything else like that. And I thought, well, I actually have enough for like a little kind of overture here, in which you state all the principal themes of what's going to happen over the next however many minutes it was. I didn't know how long it was going to be at first. Obviously, I knew it was going to be reasonably long. So you have this kind of little overture bit at the beginning. So I wrote that and sketched that out and then started to just tell the story. And that was just mechanics of telling the story and how many verses you should have and how we should kind of build it. I didn't think too much about that until I actually got the lyrics together up until the moment when the airship sort of set sail, as it were. And for that, I used a piece which was written rather sad, actually. It was written when John Lord was ill. I was mucking around on keyboards, and I wrote this little thing, and I thought, well, if he ever gets better, we'll call it sort of a wedding march or something. And he nearly did get better, but he didn't quite. So, but the bit that I call the wedding of earth and sky, which is the bit that bit, it's kind of, I called it a wedding march, I mean, but that's kind of what it sounded like to me. And it was designed to have bells and God knows what on it. And that's what happens as the airship sets off, because it was a moment of triumph. It was a fleeting moment of victory for everybody there, and the crowds were there. It was a massive national event. The press were all there. Of course, I believe it was the Minister of Aviation stood on the steps as he went up to the airship and declared that there was only the millionth chance that anything could possibly go wrong. A millionth chance, he laughed, to take down His Majesty's craft. To India, they say, magic carpet float away. And I imagine that that's what would happen, you know, because they had this sense of the great white heat of technology, as it was back then, of course, of invulnerability. So off it went, and of course, as the airship dropped its water ballast, everybody with their upturned faces would have gotten a little bit wet, and there's sort of a baptism, as it were, as the airship disappeared into the darkening skies over Bedfordshire from Cardington. And of course, it got as far as Beauvais, and there it hit the most monumental storm. So at first, when it leaves, you get this, and then you get this little, which for anybody who's into Morse code, which there aren't that many people left anymore, is actually SOS. It's dot, 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 dash, dash, dash. That's the rhythm of that. It turns into. So then we're into a big sleigh ride, basically. And that's the little Celtic, the jiggy bit, you know, if you like, which was, again, was written for sort of Irish fiddles and a rhythmic instrument called a burren, which is something that's used mainly in sort of Cadley bands and things like that. But the that one. So I thought, well, all of these things were written on instruments like piano and designed for fiddles and French horns and everything else. None of it was written for a guitar. And I thought, well, that's okay, because as soon as we get it into Maiden world, it's going to get maidenized. It has no option. So we'll just see what that sounds like. It'll be interesting. But of course, the Celtic-y type bit is sort of familiar to us anyway, because, you know, I mean, it's been used a lot as a device in rock music. And, you know, everybody from Thin Lizzy onwards has had a nod in the direction of little Irishy type things. So that cracks on there, and there's a couple of solos. And then basically you're getting to the point where the storm happens, and we learn a bit about how terrible it is. You know, the ship's rolling, it's rocking, you know, it's exciting, but it's starting to get a little bit dangerous. And then you get this kind of staccato, weird timing type thing, which they told me what the timing was. Everybody goes, oh, that's weird timing. I said, well, I don't know what it is. I just wrote it on piano. That bit. So that's your storm, and then you're back to the previous bit for a reprise of that and some more vocals telling the story, and then the storm bit happens again, and then you finally get the bit where the skin fractures and the nose of the ship starts to drop, and you get the Nico's famous bowed gong, in which he took me out and scraped a violin bow on his orchestral gong and made this very horrendous nails on the blackboard metallic sort of sound, which sounded to me like a load of metal being crunched up.
Every day we would be working together, you know, he'd show me a bit more of this, and I said, gosh, he said, it's going to be a really long song. I don't know how long it's going to come in, Nick. He said, but I've got this bit in the middle, then I've got this Morse code. How are we going to do this Morse code bit? He said, I said, well, you know, we just have to work it out when we get there. So the whole story started to take shape with me earlier on before we started recording it. And then we were working out how to express musically the story of this airship, as well as the vocals and lyrics telling the story of, you know, its maiden voyage. We did whole bunches of bit different stuff. We put timpanis on it, military snare drum. We put a bowed gong in the middle section after when the airship's, you know, all the discord bit. So there's Bruce sitting on a piano, and I've gone, Iron Maiden on a piano. That was really weird to get my head around. But there we go. We have this opus, this incredible piece of music. You know, and I saw all the passion that he had where he was writing. He was crossing lyrics out and he was putting things together. And that was just, it just blew my mind. And then when we did the piece of music, well, the pieces of music, you know, there's so many sections in there. We all just embraced it. And I remember Steve coming in one morning. We all got to the studio. Bruce and Steve were in, and Bruce was showing Steve all these different parts of the song because he pretty much got the sketch together and was showing Steve. And Steve just went, wow, that's incredible. And, you know, we were all just so excited. When are we going to play this song? You know, and I think it was the last track we did, and we really spent a lot of time getting each section right.
And then that's it. It's over, apart from, you know, the tinkling of bits of glass and metal and sound of raindrops at the end of it. So I couldn't end the song like that. I thought, right, I really need to have some message of hope at the end of it. So we reprise the ba-da-da-da-dum, da-dum-dum-dum, but with the big chords underneath and then the sort of a vocal line over the top, you know, about the dreams and the standing there in the sun. And, of course, I've been to Cardington quite a few times. I've been to the sheds where they built the airship. They're still there. The airship that I'm involved is inside one of them. And I've been to the tomb that's there that's incredibly poignant. I mean, it's this very quiet, you know, rather beautiful traditional English village with this tomb there. And I stood there, and because I stood there, I wrote the words. That's what it made you feel. Really, we're just getting towards the end of the song now. So I thought, well, we'll repeat the beginning bit very quietly and just in a very dignified way, just sign off to all these people that came unwittingly to die in France. And that's sort of the story of the telling of the story and how I approached it, you know, musically, in terms of the way I approached it sort of thematically, as it were. In terms of how I wrote it, I mean, I wrote it on a keyboard at home, which was simulating a piano. And then I got to the studio and was adding more bits to it on this rather magnificent Steinway they had, which made my two-fingered piano skills sound much better than they really were. Of course, when we had to record the piano, I ended up having to play it. Well, I couldn't play the Steinway because we'd have been there till Christmas trying to get a good take. So we had to go back two steps in time and go back to MIDI, which none of us could remember how to actually do anymore. I think Kevin had to go and get the manual out and went, how on earth does this stuff work? You know. But yeah, I had this kind of like very strange little sort of clinky plonk keyboard, which I did, and then for the piano parts, which meant that we could edit the odd bum note, of which there were more than one or two of the odd bum notes. We could at least edit them and make sure that they were in the right place at the right time, approximately. And then we just assigned a grand piano sample to it. I mean, if ever we did this song live, I would just make sure that we got a proper pianist to go do it, because I would actually have heart failure. You know, because you have no idea how terrible it would be. You sit there going, da 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 ding, oh no, sorry, you know. I do love writing on piano. I do love it. It's an incredible thing to write on. I just wished I was a bit better at it in terms of actually playing it. Yeah, that's how we did that. And then we introduced it to the rest of the band. You know, it was a bit challenging because we've never been as sort of freeform as this at the beginning of a song. Ever. There's normally at least some kind of click track or timing or something. Well, the only timing on this song for the first, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes is actually the piano. So people have to play pluck notes out of thin air and just sort of deliver them into space and hope that everything all works together. So we spent a while doing that, but it was challenging, but it was really interesting process, you know. We had to keep people just focused and on track, because I thought if we lose anybody here, we're not going to come back until next week, you know. But it went really well. As soon as we get into the then, you know, it's maiden, we're off to the races, and everybody can do that, you know. Nico was fantastic during it. I mean, he was driving the song from the beginning, not just technically but also emotionally. He really got it. Steve was listening as I was tinkering away through the whole writing process and seeing what was going to come next. And when I showed him all the bits, and there was about 4 or 5 pages of written arrangement, really, just a big list of what happens next, he said, "Oh, that's great." I went, "What?" Just like, as is. He went, "Yeah." I went, "Okay." Well, let's see what happens next. Kevin was forever telling me not to rush it, because I got halfway through writing it and he was, "This is going to be really special." I went, "Well, yeah." He said, "Don't rush it." He said, just keep going at it until you're happy. And if you're not happy, just don't show it to anybody till you've figured it out. I went, "All right, okay." Vote of confidence there. It's just that had I known, I'd probably have done a bit more, because we ran out of time in the end with it. However, it's a nice situation to have, because if I ever decide to go and try and get the song done, like for real, like with a real orchestra on a stage, there's quite a few things I'd like to muck about with. I'd quite like to extend it a bit and do all kinds of things to it, which would be potentially quite interesting. But for now, we live with it as it is. I think it's pretty cool. The biggest compliment anybody ever pays to that song that I can dig out, but on the fact that they like it, is that they say, "I keep listening to it, it just never feels like 18 minutes. I can't believe it's like 18 minutes. It feels like, you know, 7 or 8 minutes have gone by, you know. I just never figured that one out." Well, that's the best compliment you can get, because it means that there's interesting things happening and the transitions are just tickling your brain and your emotions, and you're just, you know, your musical palate is constantly being refreshed, you know.
It was such a wonderful experience working with Bruce on that song. We everybody embraced it, and the head scratching bit didn't last very long when we were thinking piano, Iron Maiden, you know. it's just magic.
And that is the story of Empire of the Clouds.